Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa.
I'm Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today, together with Gina McAndrews and Mike Murphy, to wish you a joyous St. Patrick's Day. And thanks to Michael for the Irish music he played on You Name It last week. Let's have a little Irish music to get us into the spirit for the day.
An unusually celebratory local talk today. This is also Women's History Month, which gives us a special reason to congratulate Ballard on winning the 4A Conference Championship in girls basketball.
Regular listeners to a local talk have noticed that we rarely cover sports events, but our attention was drawn to this game because it took place just following the premiere of a movie about the end of 6-on-6 girls basketball from decades past. Did you ever play 6-on-6 basketball, Gina?
I did, back in 7th and 8th grade, when back in Dubuque County. But it was a lot of fun. I always wondered why we had to stop at that middle line. I always thought that was just frustrating because you couldn't go across to follow through to make a basket. You either had to be on the defense or on the offense. Did you?
Oh, no. I avoided sports. Actually, I made arrangements so that I could take outside gym. And then I learned the rules of the game, but I didn't have to play it. I hated ball games. So, in fact, I was unhappy when Title IX came in. I mean, not if I had been a student, I would have hated being forced to play all those games.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, but it was fun. And yeah, I heard about the movie and how the Bombers won the state tournament. It was a pretty dramatic game, too, by the sounds of it. One of the things the small town papers do really well in their sports reporting is it includes a lot of color photos and a lot of descriptions. I mean, I took a lot of journalism and I'm sure writing about a basketball game again and again and again can be challenging, but some of them are really good at, you know, using their description words to really get the idea out there.
Yeah, I think the best writers are out there doing the sports stories. They really put their heart into it. And so we could tell that and it was fun to see the same names in the movie write-up as there were in the games.
And yes.
I think a lot of younger people can't imagine why 6-on-6 basketball was such a big deal and why Iowans loved it so much. Paul Grierson couldn't be with us today. He's had his COVID shot, so he's flying down to Atlanta today to visit his brother on his birthday, like he does most years. But before he left, I got him to tell me some history of 6-on-6.
Do you remember the 6-on-6 girls basketball?
Oh, certainly. I was in high school from 1957 to 61, and that was right still in the middle of the 6-on-6 girls basketball. And the unique thing about girls basketball was that we were so into assigned sex roles in those days and traditional values about men and women, boys and girls, that all the names of the teams were feminized. We were Story City Vikings, and our girls team was the Vi-Queens, okay? And if the boys were the Hawks, the girls were the Hawkettes. And they had neat little uniforms, nice little outfits, little skirts. And it was just so much in line with how people perceived sexual differences at that time. And, of course, that made the game different. The boys played as they do today. And, of course, today girls play exactly like the boys, full court. But in the 6-on-6 girl era, it was half court. In fact, my mother played basketball in 1924 and 25, and that was half court too. In the girls' game, you had guard court and offense court. And so the girls who played guard never got a chance to shoot the basketball. They were playing defense when the other team was on offense. And then they took the ball across the timeline, and then, of course, it switched. Let's say the Hawkettes were playing the Vi-Queens. Well, if the Vi-Queens had the ball, they'd try to score, and the Hawkettes would guard them. And if they got the rebound, they'd try to get it back across the timeline so the Hawkettes could score. And so girls played offense and defense exclusively. And it was based on the idea that if girls did too much running, that might damage their ability to be pregnant, you know, or we have so many traditional ideas about girls not exerting themselves. And that was the basis for 6-on-6 basketball. So girls didn't have to run so much. And they played offense and defense exclusively, depending on whether they had the ball. And the court was just rigidly divided on the timeline because we just didn't think girls should run that much. And the other thing about the girls' game was you couldn't continuously dribble. A girl who had the ball could only dribble twice. And so that cut down the running, too. It was just the assumption that somehow girls weren't capable or shouldn't run as much as boys do. So that was the unique part of the game. It was a half-court game where girls played. Of course, a girl who played guard never got the opportunity to shoot. And the girls who were on offense did play some defense to prevent the other team from getting the ball across the timeline. So you just say that 6-on-6 girls was a half-court basketball game, and that's how it was played. And it was really a big deal in Iowa. For some reason, it had much more allure than the boys, and it was well-attended. And it was a real boon to small towns. Several small towns became famous because they had very effective coaches and good leaders. And they built programs that spanned many years of going to the state tournament. And that meant that very small towns, I remember Missouri and Gladbrook, and there were just several powers. And in the girls' game, the girls had very high points totals. Some girls would score 20, 30 points. Career totals for some of the girls were phenomenal compared to what's going on today because they were really specialists in shooting the ball. And it was just fantastic. These girls became celebrities. And then, of course, all these people from small towns would go into Des Moines for the tournament. And I remember when our girls' team, the Vi-Queens, made the state tournament, that Story City essentially emptied out. That was true of all the small towns. The whole town went to Des Moines, which made it difficult because a lot of these folks were not used to driving in urban traffic. And I remember during the girls' tournament when I lived in Des Moines and my career was down there, you really had to be alert because a lot of the people made a lot of big, serious driving errors, and they were totally out of their element, you know. But when they got to Veterans Auditorium, that was the panacea, and everybody aspired to that, and it was an honor to make it down there. And your team was on display from your small town, and there were just hundreds of more school districts at that time than there are today. So the pathway to the tournament was a lot more challenging because there were just a lot of school districts compared to what there are today there to make the state tournament. The Sweet 16, they called it. The 16 teams that made the state tournament, and that was prestigious to make that tournament. It's frightening how many school districts there used to be in the 50s compared to how many there are now.
In case you just tuned in, we've been celebrating Ballard winning the 4A Girls Basketball Championship with many of the players playing in the movie New Providence.
Yes, that was really something to see and read about. I can't even imagine what it was like because a lot of the girls who actually played in the championship had to learn to play 6-on-6 basketball for the movie.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, it must have been real. If you thought it was frustrating, imagine what it would be if you've been playing full court and you suddenly had to go back to 6-on-6.
I bet there were a couple bad words here and there.
Well, I know from the pictures they sure were happy in the tournament.
Oh, I imagine. Yes, that's exciting.
And New Providence, the movie, is actually playing in quite a few movie theaters in the area. And it's on Netflix. You can get it on, what is it, Amazon Prime.
Oh, wow.
So it's not on Netflix itself, but is that on Amazon Prime?
Well, that's neat that it's in the theater, too.
Yeah, and the girls commented in the story about them that it was really exciting to see it on a big screen because, you know, a lot of them, I don't know, maybe they've seen very, very few things on a big screen, but to see yourself playing basketball on a big screen.
Oh, yeah. Whole different thing than the TV news or other things, I'm sure.
Right. Well, last Monday, Ursula had a segment for Women's History Month about the Cranford Apartments on Lincoln Way across from Lake Laverne, which were originally built as housing for women faculty members. That made me think of the time I visited one of those faculty members in her apartment in the Cranford. This would have been about 1968. Her name was Dorothy Lee, and she was such an outstanding influence on me that I wanted to honor her during this month. So I asked her colleague, David Gradwall, to tell me who she was.
Dorothy was a professor of anthropology. She got her PhD in California and worked in terms of anthropological linguistics. That was her main training. She married Dr. Otis Lee, who was a philosopher. So she was very influenced in her anthropological work by the field of linguistics and by philosophy. She was born in Constantinople when it was still part of the Ottoman Empire in 1905. And came to the States. So she had an interesting European and American background, somewhat differing worldviews and academic perspectives. Iowa State University was becoming a university. It had been a college, but was becoming a university, and it was getting more involved with different academic disciplines, particularly the arts and humanities, and they were getting involved in overseas international operations. And the Home Economics College, as it was called then, had gotten into a joint venture with Baroda University in India, where they would have exchanges. And Iowa State University would be sending students to Baroda University and then bringing them back in their various capacities, better understanding cross-cultural and cross-national cultural behaviors and international perspectives. So through Dorothy Lee, the College of Home Economics was encouraged and did establish a class, an introduction to cultural anthropology that was required for every major in the home economics college. That involved, of course, people, mostly women, in home ec majors, in apparel design and foods and management and so forth. But also they were developing a hospitality track, and that had proportionately more men. So both men and women majoring in anything in home ec college was required to take a cultural anthropology class. So voila, the Department of Agricultural Economics and Rural Sociology needed anthropologists. So I was hired as the first full-time anthropologist at Iowa State. I replaced a man named Philip Lease, who was a social anthropologist whose specialty was sub-Saharan Africa. And he could not wait to get out of here because there wasn't much to support him. And I was only too happy to take over his job because I wanted to return to the Midwest, which was where I had done my dissertation research in archaeology. So basically, I was the only anthropologist here at Iowa State University. And that first year I taught mostly small sections of Introduction to Cultural Anthropology.
So how did you meet Dorothy Lee?
She taught here at Iowa State University. Usually we were on the quarter system then, one regular quarter and one short summer session. And in between, she would be on other campuses, and particularly in California. So before I left the Ivy beleaguered halls of Harvard, my Brahmin professors there called me aside and said, Dorothy Lee is at Iowa State and avoid her at all costs. She had alienated them to a degree because she railed against the traditional canon in anthropology. She eschewed the use of ethnographies and wanted to use linguistic and philosophical and personal approaches to the subject. So I came here dreading to meet this woman whom I'd been told about and resenting if she was going to tell me how to teach anthropology. But when I got here, I made a point to go over and meet her. And boy, every stereotype I had and everything I'd been told about her was absolutely wrong. She was a sweet woman, very dignified. She had her opinions, which she would share with you, but she was not pushy and not about to insist that you follow her ideas. And she explained to me why she thought the students in home ec and other students, for that matter, ought to have an introduction to cultural anthropology. in terms of cross-cultural and cross-national interests and tolerance. And I certainly agreed with everything there. And so I taught it my way. But I got to know Dorothy, and I knew that she gave a seminar once a year, and that students and other people I had bumped into that took her seminar just loved it. And after a couple of years, I became the professor in charge of anthropology, and I was in charge of scheduling classes. And I was thus scheduling Dorothy Lee's seminar, and I called her in California, and I said, when did she want to, what night, or tended to teach that seminar at night so working people could take it. Said, when do you want to give the seminar? What is the title? And she said, David, you know how I hate to label things. And I stifled a laughter because, you know, hello, she was trained in linguistic anthropology and philosophy. That's where you label things. And I said, well, Dorothy, if I had my way, I would just put in the catalog and the schedule of classes, Dorothy Lee's seminar. And the people that knew Dorothy Lee or in the know otherwise would know what the seminar was, and the others wouldn't. And I said, but I can't do that. I can't just put in Dorothy Lee's seminar. And she said, okay, call it Alienation in Existence. And I laughed because I thought, well, that'll cover a multitude of sins. So she gave the course for a few years, and I decided that I wanted to sit in the class. And she said, that would be fine. She said, but it's not anthropology. And I said, well, why don't you let me worry about what it is? So I went to her class, and I believe that was the same one in which you enrolled. And I became most intrigued about how you could read a novel and turn that discussion into anthropology. And we read also some autobiographies, and that had a big impact in me because I ended up using autobiographies in my American Indian Studies class, the ethnology of Native North America. And in our cultural anthropology classes, we ended up using fiction. These weren't anthropology books, but they were resources upon which you could get students to talk and then pull it around to major themes in anthropology.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and your hosts for today have been Gina McAndrews and Susan Franzen. In selecting Dorothy Lee to honor for Women's History Month, I mentioned she was very influential to me. And testimony to that, in part, I can say that I remember when David and I started talking about his, what he was going to say about Dorothy Lee, we could both remember the books we read and the things we talked about. Now, this is 50 years ago. There are not very many classes that you could remember that vividly. And that's how much of an impression she made on both of us. And in his case, of course, the way he expanded his view of anthropology. Of course, this is my introduction to anthropology, so I didn't, but I knew a lot of novels, which I'll talk about later. I was very receptive to the idea of getting information out of novels because I had grown up reading European novels, and that's just, it was a sort of an odd thing that I did, but, and there wasn't anybody to talk to about them. But a couple of years later, in the later 60s and early 70s, when I had become a graduate student, I was invited to be part of a team teaching the first History of Women course offered at Iowa State. I didn't have any part in designing the course, and each of the others had a specialized area. One was a Latin American historian, one was a Chinese historian, of course, a couple were American historians, so I got women in Europe. Of course, I had never looked at history that way, except for a few queens. I didn't know where to look, except for novels. And since I'd grown up reading European literature, I knew a lot of novels, and I quickly realized that, as with Dorothy Lee's use of novels to understand the inside of a culture, that novels were a way to understand the lives of women in Europe, because they were the subject to a lot of novels or very important characters. Of course, the women's movement inspired a great many women to write in all genres that had not been, they hadn't thought of doing before, I guess, including mysteries and science fiction. Most recently, I've noticed several women in Ames writing their first romances and telling about them. There have been articles in the paper, they've given talks at Dog-Eared Books, and even a couple of women are teaching about how to write about women and social justice in romance novels. And I was thinking about inviting one of these women for Women's History Month. And then I realized that I recently learned of a woman who had written romances for years and had taught romance writing in New York. I thought her career would be an interesting subject. So I called her, and I'll let her introduce herself and tell you how and why she writes.
I'm Lee Michaels, and I am a native Iowan who has been writing romance since, the Dark Ages. I wrote 80 books for Harlequin Books, for Harlequin Romances and Harlequin Presents. And then after that, I took a bit of a break and turned to writing historical single-title romance set in the British Regency period, which is 1810 to 1820. It provided a wonderful change for me and a new outlook on romance. So I have done both. I have published traditionally, I've independently published, and I've been doing this for a large number of years. I also teach romance writing at Gotham Writers Workshop in New York City, online classes through Gotham. And I have had a lovely career. I've been published in 27 languages in 120 countries around the world, and have been nominated 6 times for the READA, which is the Romance Writers of America contest for Best Romance of the Year.
Well, what is the difference between writing a romance and writing a novel?
Well, a lot of people get confused between about the difference between a love story and a romance novel. A love story can be very much involved in a regular novel. A regular novel can be very much a love story, is perhaps a better way to put it. The romance novel, the relationship is at the focus of that book. If you take out that relationship, then the romance novel is no more. It is not a viable story. Where in a literary novel that includes a love story, the love story may be very important, but it could be taken out of there and there would still be a story because it's more about the development of a single character.
Well, of course, romances are sometimes called bodice rippers and other derogatory terms that imply that they're a little racy.
Not only that they're racy, but that they're all alike. I've actually been asked by a reader at one time, she said, "Do you use a computer?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I do." And she said, "Well, that must make things easier when all you have to do is change the color of the eyes and crank out another book. Well, that's hardly the case. Just as all mysteries have certain things in common, all romance novels have certain things in common, but that doesn't make all stories alike. Yes, they've been called bodice rippers and implied that they're racy, and there are romances that are very erotic and include a great deal more consummated sex and all that sort of thing, but that is not true of all romances.
Well, what are the characteristics that they have in common?
All romances have in common two main characters, which is usually a hero and a heroine, but not always. They have a situation, a problem that these people have to solve. They have a committed relationship at the end to some extent, and that will depend on whether it's an adult romance or it is a young adult romance, or a chick lit, which can have a committed relationship for the moment, but perhaps not for all time. And they all have a happy ending. In that happy ending, all the issues are resolved, and the reader is confident that this couple can go forward, perhaps forever, happily together.
That's a pretty tall order.
It is a tall order, and that's why it is fiction. It's not reality. Sometimes, you know, romance is fantasy. I was also asked one time, well, aren't romances just like soap operas? And the answer to that is no, they're actually pretty much the opposite. In a soap opera, even if a couple gets together and is happy, you know that 6 months down the road they're going to have problems in their relationship because that's how the soap opera continues. Romance is the other way around. We're assured of that happy ending. And that fantasy is why so many readers like to read these books. They know that even if they're going on a roller coaster along the way, even if there are all kinds of troubles and pain, heartache throughout the book, they're guaranteed that at the end there will be a happy, satisfying, resolved ending. And that's what makes a romance very reassuring to read, fun to read. And readers of romance also read many other things, but they often will pick up a romance when they want to relax, want to be assured of that happy ending.
Writing on a computer just makes it easier to keep up with your thoughts. That's been my experience.
It does make it easier to type fast, and it makes it much easier to edit. In the old days, before I was using a computer, making a change of a name was terribly difficult, or changing one thing in a manuscript would cause you to have to retype the whole thing. And now that's so much easier to do with a computer, but it doesn't make the writing any easier.
What makes the writing difficult?
Always coming up with new things, new ways to look at things, and letting characters develop so that their story is accurate and consistent with their behavior and their past. Sometimes it's just difficult to get a plot to work out the way that I want it to. And many times that's because I haven't got a good view of the character, or I've let the character become a wimp rather than a strong person. I like writing about strong people.
Why have your novels been so successful in translation?
You know, that's a really, really interesting question. The publisher does have branches around the world, and so many of their books do go in translation. But my first editor told me that mine went into translation more quickly and more easily because I was trained as a journalistic writer. And she said, your writing is very precise, your vocabulary is very precise, and that makes them easy to translate.
So you actually started as a journalist?
My degree is in journalism, yes. I have a bachelor's in journalism from Drake University. And my intention was to be a newspaper reporter or perhaps feature writer. And instead, I ended up writing romances. It was something that I always enjoyed reading. And from the time that I was a kid in high school, I would read the romances that were coming out that month, and I'd say, oh, you know, I don't like how that ended. I don't like how that developed. I wish they'd done this instead. Or I would read any kind of book, and then I would take it on to what happened to those characters after the book was over. But, you know, that was how my mind worked, and I always was a writer. I wrote my first attempt at a romance novel when I was 14, and thankfully maintained enough common sense to burn it. But I was quite young when my first books were written and were brought out.
How did you go from being a journalist to being a romance writer? Obviously, it was natural. But
it was a natural process. When I graduated from college, I was also getting married, and I married the man who was the photographer at the local newspaper. And so the newspaper would not hire me because they didn't want couples working there. So I went to work for the radio station. I did that for a while. I did public relations for a while, and I ended up as a reference librarian. And during all that time, I entertained myself by writing stories. So I had written and burned 6 complete manuscripts. And when I wrote the 7th one, it had a different feel to it. And I thought, you know, I've pretty much learned as much as I can on my own. And this is long enough ago that there were not romance writing classes. There were very few organizations to help. There were no local chapters of Romance Writers of America. There was nothing really out there. So I thought the only way I'm going to learn how to take this to the next level is to send it in to a publisher and hope that I get a letter back that says, are you kidding? Of course not. But here's what you did wrong. So I sent that book off. I mailed it on Friday the 13th and sent it to Harlequin, to the office in Toronto. And it came back to me 4 months later from the office in England with a letter that said, well, you haven't hit it quite, but we think if you do this and this and this and this, that we can publish this book. And so it was a much better result than I had ever dreamed to hope for. I did a full revision of that book. I did a second set of smaller revisions, and that was the first sale that I made.
This sounds like a dream career.
It has in many ways been a dream career. I worked exclusively with Harlequin for close to 20 years, writing 80 books. I was writing 3 and 4 books a year for them, and thoroughly enjoyed that part of my career, but I did get a little burned out there at the end, where I kept thinking, I just don't have another new contemporary romance. And that was when I turned to thinking more about historicals. Definitely different. The research that goes into writing historical is immense, because it isn't only a matter of, you know, putting in horses instead of cars. It's a matter of letting those characters in that book think in the way that people of that time would think, and express themselves in the way that people of that time would think, rather than looking at things through a modern lens. In 1810, it was well before any study of psychology and psychiatry, and therefore many of the things that are normal concepts for us, egotism, self-esteem, all that kind of thing, they had those things, but they wouldn't have thought of them in those terms and in those same ways we do. So a lot of times language and the concepts, the thought processes of a historical character are very difficult to get right.
So how much are your books changed when they're translated?
Some of them are changed a fair bit. I can make out enough French to know that one of my books ended up being very zodiac focused, very, very horoscope focused. And I questioned my editor about that. And she said, oh dear, I did hope you didn't read enough French to figure that out. We've fired that translator. In general, they do a very good job of translating. Where I've been able to check, the friend who was a Spanish language instructor, and he read a Spanish edition and the English edition, and said they've done a really wonderful job of keeping the concepts, keeping the ideas. There are a couple of places that are absolutely fascinating in how they handle translations. One of them is Korea. because in South Korea, they occasionally publish a double volume, which is both the English version and the Korean translation. And I think they're using them, students who want to study English. And it's a great way because they can consult the two versions and practice their English and their concepts. The Chinese is also very interesting because they run a glossary in the back of the book. They'll immediately translate the English comparison or image and then explain it. So if you've used an allusion that may not be something that translates directly, they will explain it and give examples of what this means. So again, it's a way for people to practice their English in more than just grammatical style. It's so that they are understanding the many ways that we use the English language that often don't make sense to people who are just learning it.
When you translate, do you ever translate the location? Are all your, I presume most of your books take place in the U.S. And when they translate, do they also stay here?
They do stay here, and they keep the small town atmosphere. My specialty in the contemporary romance was small town Midwestern romance. It was romance with a heart, the heart of the Midwest. And so that seems to appeal to a great many readers around the world who find that location and that idea very exotic. For those of us who grew up in small town Iowa, it's like, this is same old. But for someone who lives in a city or who lives, in a very different culture, it is unique to them to see how things operate in a small town.
Thank you so very much.
Returning to what's coming up in Ames for St. Patrick's Day, fans of Stevens Auditorium can celebrate St. Patrick's Day and support the Ames venue at the same time. Ireland with Michael, a virtual concert, begins Wednesday at 7 p.m., that's tonight, as a video-on-demand performance featuring world-renowned Irish tenor Michael Londra. Virtual tickets will be good through Friday at 7 p.m., according to the news release. Purchasing the video on demand ticket from that link directly supports Stevens Auditorium. An Emmy nominated Irish singer and producer, Londra grew up in Ireland and now lives in Ames. He became well known in the United States as the lead singer for the national tour of Riverdance. In March 2000, he became lead singer in the production of Riverdance on Broadway, which was a springboard for his recording and producing career, according to his biography. The virtual show is a celebration of Irish culture and music for the Irish American Heritage Month in March. And here's a song by Michael Londra that will introduce you to him if you haven't met him yet. And I think if you go online with him, you can probably see this. It's a lot of fun to watch him because he's speaking from his backyard. And I don't recognize it, but it looks like it certainly could be a backyard in Ames. So here's Michael.
Hello, everybody. My name is Michael Londra. I'm an Irish singer and producer based a million miles away from Ireland right now, where I'm isolating with my family here in Ames in Iowa. I miss my hometown so much. Let me tell you about it. It's right on the corner of Ireland, on the southeast of Ireland's ancient east. It's a town called Wexford. In the heart of the town is the National Opera House, where I learned how to sing. And flowing out from that opera house are great pubs all around it, where the singing continues, right down to the water. And right on the water, the trawlers bring in the catch of the day. Just outside the town, you've got the amazing Johnstown Castle. You've got Curraghcloe, the beach where Saving Private Ryan was filmed. The whole place is as idyllic as it sounds. I can't go there right now. And the only way that kind of fills my heart is by listening to Irish music and Irish singing. So I thought I'd leave a song for you that I hope will fill your heart with Ireland. Enjoy it.
Waters wide, I can't cross through, neither have I wings to fly. Give me a boat that will carry two, and both shall rule, my love and I. A ship there is, she sails the sea. She's loaded deep, as deep can be, but not so deep as the love I'm in. I know not if I sink or swim.
Like myself, I know you can't leave your own home right now, but I hope the song filled your heart with Ireland, and we'll meet sometime in Ireland's ancient East. Bye for now.
Well, that was Michael Londra, and if he's going to be giving a virtual concert at C.Y. Stevens. And in order to find that the song, I went online and I found him, the beginning part where he's talking to us is filmed in what looks like a backyard. And I wondered, could that really be in Ames? And then when I talked to Gina, she told me she knew that what yard very well because she sold him his house. Gina, do you want to talk about that?
Oh, yes. I had a wonderful time. Michael is truly a sincere and terrific person that has a wonderful sense of humor as well as a wonderful voice. But yes, I've had the great opportunity to help him and Mark buy their house. And yeah, they're truly great people to work with. And but part of the reason they love their house was the back garden had kind of an Irish English garden twist to it. And yeah, I'm sure they've made it into their wonderful home. And yeah, I'm really excited to hear about his show. And I've gone to several of his performances that he's had here in Ames. And he's just a wonderful singer that has a great sense of humor and such a broad breadth of just abilities and talents to sing and act. And just a very genuine and loving person that is just fun to be around. And I'm truly looking forward. I have to get my ticket yet for the show. I'm thinking I'm even going to buy my parents a ticket because they really love the Irish music. And actually, last year we were supposed to go to Ireland. I had saved up my money to take them to Ireland because my ancestors are all from County Mayo. And anyway, with the virus and everything, we didn't get to go. But this will be a little treat maybe for them.
Well, thank you, Gina. You never know on Local Talk what connections you're going to make.
That's true.
I'm not sure that it was clear. Your day job is that you're a realtor, so.
Yes, yep. Well, I sure enjoy the KHOI radio show.
Well, thank you. We sure enjoy your being here and keeping it going. You have been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Radio. Remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI provides a platform for citizens and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is community nonprofits, nonpartisan media. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Other voices you heard were Paul Wearson, Lee Michaels, and David Gradball. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Ireland's Call by Celtic Fire and The Waters Wide by Michael Londra.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, please contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or you can contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us. If you decide to become a member, or you can renew your membership today, just hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button at our great website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
They said it couldn't be done in these times, but together we did it. This winter, KHOI asked for $60,000 in membership donations to keep broadcasting in central Iowa. One by one, you and other KHOI listeners got us there. Thank you for your support.
You are enriching our community with the sounds of local voices and national grassroots voices. You are providing real information that helps us all understand and navigate these unprecedented and eventful times.
Do you know what that is? Okay, obviously it's ABBA. More than ABBA, it's a song that's available on 8-Track and owned by Bob Anders. You can find it at Bob's 8-Track garage sale. If it was produced and put on one of these cartridges, Bob is likely to send it out live over the airwaves. The only terrestrial radio show in the world that is all live and all 8-Track. Bob Anders is your host. He'll fix that 8-Track and make it music to your ears. Bob's 8-Track garage sale goes on every Thursday from 11 a.m. till noon on KHOY 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.